Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ted Kooser. Ted Kooser is the author of 11 collections of poetry, including Delights and Shadows, published by Copper Canyon in 2004 and winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. Also, Winter Morning Walks, 100 Postcards to Jim Harrison, which won the 2001 Nebraska Book Award for Poetry, and 4 books of poetry from the University of Pittsburgh Press, Weather Central in 1994, One World at a Time in 1985, Sure Signs in 1980, and Flying at Night, 2005. His fiction and nonfiction books include Braided Creek, A Conversation in Poetry, written with fellow poet and longtime friend Jim Harrison, and Local Wonders, Seasons in the Bohemian Alps, which won the Nebraska Book Award for Nonfiction in 2003. His honors include 2 NEA Fellowships in Poetry, a Pushcart Prize, the Stanley Kunitz Prize from Columbia, and a Merit Award from the Nebraska Arts Council. In 2004, Ted Kooser was appointed the Library of Congress's 13 Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry. We're really excited to have you here, Ted.
Thank you very much, Jan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, and you're going to start with just reading some poems.
All right. Okay. This is a poem I always like to start my readings with. It says something about the priorities of the audience. Selecting a reader. First, I would have her be beautiful and walking carefully up on my poetry at the loneliest moment of an afternoon, her hair still damp at the neck from washing it. She should be wearing a raincoat, an old one, dirty from not having money enough for the cleaners. She will take out her glasses, and there in the bookstore, she will thumb over my poems, then put the book back up on its shelf. She will say to herself, "For that kind of money, I can get my raincoat cleaned," and she will. I've written a lot of poems about ordinary things, the sound the furnace makes when it goes on, the sound the refrigerator makes when it goes on, things about the house, and so on. This is a poem typical of that kind of writing. The Leaky Faucet. All through the night, the leaky faucet searches the stillness of the house with its radar blip. Who is awake? Who lies out there as full of worry as a pan in the sink? Cheer up, the little faucet calls. Someone will help you through your life. I had a lot of fun with that, getting that little blip in there and then that cheer up sound.
Nice.
Yeah. It's a little longer one. I've always been fascinated by weather lore of one kind or another, and I love it that the weather is the one thing we can't control, and that no matter how powerful we've become as far as being able to destroy everything on the face of the earth, still when a big storm comes up, we hide in the ground like rodents and so on. How to foretell a change in the weather. Rain always follows the cattle sniffing the air and huddling in fields with their heads to the lee. You will know that the weather is changing when your sheep leave the pasture too slowly and your dogs lie about and look tired, when the cat turns her back to the fire, washing her face, and the pigs wallow in litter. Cocks will be crowing at unusual hours, flapping their wings. Hens will chant. When your ducks and your geese are too noisy, and the pigeons are washing themselves, when the peacocks squall loudly from the tops of the trees, when the guinea fowl grates, when sparrows chip loudly and fuss in the roadway, and when swallows fly low skimming the earth, when the carrion crow croaks to himself, and wild fowl dip and wash, and when moles throw up hills with great fervor, when toads creep out in numbers, when frogs croak, when bats enter the houses, when birds begin to seek shelter, and the robin approaches your house, when the swan flies at the wind and your bees leave the hive, when ants carry their eggs to and fro, and flies bite, and the earthworm is seen on the surface of things. This poem, Abandoned Farmhouse, has been in many anthologies, and I'll read it and then I'll tell you a little story about it. Abandoned Farmhouse. He was a big man, says the size of his shoes on a pile of broken dishes by the house. A tall man, too, says the length of the bed in an upstairs room. And a good, God-fearing man, says the Bible with a broken back on the floor below the window, dusty with sun. But not a man for farming, say the fields cluttered with boulders and the leaky barn. A woman lived with him, says the bedroom wall papered with lilacs, and the kitchen shelves covered with oilcloth. And they had a child, says the sandbox made from a tractor tire. Money was scarce, say the jars of plum preserves and canned tomatoes sealed in the cellar hole. And the winter's cold, say the rags in the window frames. It was lonely here, says the narrow country road. Something went wrong, says the empty house in the weed-choked yard. Stones in the fields say he was not a farmer. The still-sealed jars in the cellar say she left in a nervous haste. And the child, its toys are strewn in the yard like branches after a storm. A rubber cow, a rusty tractor with a broken plow, a doll in overalls. Something went wrong, they say. Every year, in April, usually, I get a letter from a school somewhere, South Carolina, let's say, fifth graders, saying, Dear Mr. Couser, Miss Smith has been talking to us about your poem, Abandoned Farmhouse, and we have reached a consensus as to what went wrong. Was it really a motorcycle gang? Or was it a spaceship? And I always answer, well, yeah, it could have been that, you know.
That's great.
So on.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet laureate, Ted Couser. We're thrilled to have you here, Ted, and I wanted to ask you, what's it like receiving that call saying that you're named the next poet laureate of the United States?
Well, it's a tremendous shock. You know, what happened, I probably told this story too often, but because I sort of act like a fool in it, but I got this phone call one evening. Ted Couser, yes. Ted Couser the poet, yes. This is Prosser Gifford at the Library of Congress, and I'm calling to see how you'd like to be the next poet laureate of the United States. And I stammered around and tried to come up with a few questions to ask and everything. And finally he said, you know, I think I better call you back tomorrow. Well, I was pacing around there, and it was about 6:15 by that time, and I realized I had a couple of DVDs checked out from the video store that were overdue now by 15 minutes, and I thought, well, I'll drive over to this little town where I checked them out. It's about 12 miles, and while I go, I'll think about being the poet laureate and so on. And so I get in the car, and I start to back out the garage, and I rip the side mirror off the car on the center post of the garage, and it's hanging on the side of the car from the power cord that ran out to it. And I'm thinking, oh, come on, you know, I mean, this is really stupid, you know, it's going to cost me a lot of money. So I drive over to this town, pull into the town. I think, well, you know, those guys at the body shop work kind of late. Maybe they're still there and I can go see what this is going to cost. So I pull into the body shop and they do all the stuff with the computer. And they come back finally after a few phone calls, say, it's going to cost you $138.40. And I thought, oh, God, you know, here we go. And so I get back in the car, and all the way home I'm thinking about being the poet laureate and how stupid it is to have ripped the mirror off the car and everything. I pull back in the garage. The DVDs are still in the car. I forgot completely to return them. So it was like that, you know, again and again for the next few weeks. You know?
I bet. What a great honor.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Really something.
Yeah. I've heard you talk about your audience and how you envision your audience as sort of ordinary people who work and live and may not read poetry all the time, but that you want your poems to appeal to that audience. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. You know, I think we all have an innate need to be a part of some community. And, you know, and we write for that community by our nature. And if your community is one made up strictly of poets, then you tend to write things for that community. My community, for many years, I worked every day at a life insurance company. My community was a more a different group of people, and those were people who did not read poetry regularly, and yet I wanted to be a part of their community. I wanted to contribute something to it. So I tried to write poems that they might understand. And I had a secretary, a young woman, who I would bring my poems in the morning. I've always written early in the morning, like because I had to before work, and I'd get up at 4:30 and write till about 7, get my necktie on and go off to the office, and then I'd bring a poem in and show it to Joanne and say, well, you know, what do you think of this? And if she said, doesn't make any sense to me, then I'd go home and work on it. Mm-hmm. Because that was the community that I was trying to reach, and I've stayed with that community over the years. You know, I think in many ways that part of my success of late has been the fact that I never got caught up with any trendiness at all in poetry, that I've always tried to, you know, pretty much done my own thing, mm-hmm. Kind of blundered along in my own way. And it's very easy if you're a part of a literary community to start doing what everybody else is doing, I think.
That's right. Yeah. It's great to have that distance in a way. I was at a conference years ago, and Sharon Olds was giving this talk about the myth of accessibility and talking about, you know, she teaches classes, well, not classes, she teaches a group of patients in a hospital in New York who are primarily paraplegic, and she wanted to write a poem for them, specifically for them, and she was thinking of accessibility and wrote the poem for her patients, the patients that she was working with, and They said they didn't get it. And she said that she realized at that moment that accessibility was sort of a myth. It was like her idea of what these people might get. And she said from that point on, she started using any language she wanted to in the poem and just going back to her love of the dictionary and using all kinds of wild words. So I'm wondering what you think about that idea in terms of, you know, showing poems to your assistant, your secretary.
Well, I'm not sure what I think about it. I'll have to think about it. I have never had the opportunity of taking advantage of a whole room full of paraplegics.
Captive audience.
Yes, a very captive audience, yeah.
Okay.
But I am very interested in audience, but I respect any poet's way of going about writing. And there are lots of poets who don't want to bend over backwards for an audience, for sure.
Right. Okay, could you read more poems?
Sure. People ask me sometimes if I, you know, all my poems are rural in nature because I do live in the Great Plains and there's a lot of open space in them. But this is a poem, for instance, that could be written pretty much anywhere. Living near the rehabilitation home. Tonight she is making her way up the block by herself, throwing her heavy shoes from step to step, her lunchbox swinging out wide with the rhythmical clunk, each bone on its end and feebly bending into her pitiful gait. Where is her friend tonight, the idiot boy? Each day at this time, I see them walking together, his bright red jacket trying the dusk, her old blue coat his shadow. She moves too slowly for him, and he breaks from her hand and circles her in serious orbits, stamping his feet in the grass. Perhaps they have taken him elsewhere to live. From high on my good legs, I imagine her lonely without him, but perhaps she's happy at last. I like the idea of being on the outside like that, trying to, without imposing my own assumptions about the life of people and just simply observing them. And I've written a lot of poems like that. Let's see. In an old apple orchard. The wind's an old man to this orchard. These trees have been feeling the soft tug of his gloves for 100 years. Now it's April again, and again that old fool thinks he's young. He's combed the dead leaves out of his beard. He's put on perfume. He's gone off late in the day toward the town and come back slow in the morning reeling with bees. As late as noon, if you look in the long grass, you can see him still rolling about in his sleep. Now that would be the other kind of poem, the the more rural, out in nature kind of thing. Here's another of the more urban ones. Advice. We go out of our way to get home, getting lost in a rack of old clothing, fainting in stairwells, our pulses fluttering like moths. We will always be leaving our loves like old stoves in abandoned apartments. Early in life, there are signals of how it will be. We throw up the window one spring, and the window weights break from their ropes and fall deep in the wall. This one's sort of fun for me because it's in a voice. I don't often write in voices, but The Widow Lester. I was too old to be married, but nobody told me. I guess they didn't care enough. How it had hurt, though, catching bouquets all those years. Then I met Ivan and kept him and never knew love. How his feet stunk in the bedsheets. I could have told him to wash, but I wanted to hold that stink against him. The day he dropped dead in the field, I was watching. I was hanging up sheets in the yard, and I finished.
Nice. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ted Kooser, poet laureate of the United States, and we're thrilled to have him here. I wanted to ask you about revising. You said that when in your revision, you tend to strip the poems back to their most simplistic or to look for clarity.
Yeah, simplistic is probably not the word, okay. But simplicity, I think, perhaps. I want them to be very graceful and transparent, so that the reader goes right through the screen of the words into the experience of the poem. So I don't want anything on the surface of the page that will call the reader's attention back to the page that for them to say, well, why would he do that? Or I don't know what that word means, that sort of thing. And So I work toward that in my revision, but I don't want to give up everything. You know, it's a balance, and every poem has its own sense of balance, I think, that way. I want them to, when I'm done, I want them to look, even though I've spent hours and hours and hours revising them, I want them to look as if I just dashed them right off.
Mm-hmm. So there's a deceptive simplicity with 30, 40 revisions underneath.
That's right.
Underneath
yeah.
it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Your poems about objects or things in the environment, in the home. Can you talk about how you started writing those poems? Did it have anything to do with Neruda's work, writing about things? And
well, you know, I didn't know Neruda's work at that time, but I've since read, you know, the book of that wonderful book he did. And I wrote another book that was published in a very limited edition called The Book of Things, in which I have a lot of those things that are kind of Neruda-like. Not necessarily under his influence, because I had not really read him very carefully, frankly, until the last few years. But I like that. His book is called, isn't it, The Book of Common Things?
I think that's what it is.
But it goes back to my earliest experience of trying to write poetry and studying with Carl Shapiro at the University of Nebraska back in the 1960s and watching Carl write poems about houseflies and Buicks and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. It honors common things in a way to do that. Mm-hmm. And Neruda, of course, was really good at it.
You have some poems about your mother's death. I don't know if you have those with you or if
yeah,
you're
sure.
in the mood to read those, but some great poems.
This is a poem I wrote. My mother died on the 23rd of March, 1998, and I wrote this just a month after that. My birthday is April the 25th, and I wrote it as a letter to her. sort of posting her on what had happened since she died. Mother. Mid-April already, and the wild plums bloom at the roadside, a lacy white against the exuberant, jubilant green of new grass and the dusty, fading black of burnt-out ditches. No leaves, not yet. Only the delicate, star-petaled blossoms, sweet with their timeless perfume. You have been gone a month today, and have missed 3 rains and 1 night-long watch for tornadoes. I sat in the cellar from 6 to 8, while fat spring clouds went somersaulting, rumbling east. Then it poured, a storm that walked on legs of lightning, dragging its shaggy belly over the fields. The meadowlarks are back, and the finches are turning from green to gold. Those same 2 geese have come to the pond again this year, honking in over the trees and splashing down. They never nest, but stay a week or two, then leave. The peonies are up, the red sprouts burning in circles like birthday candles, for this is the month of my birth, as you know, the best month to be born in, thanks to you, everything ready to burst with living. There will be no more new flannel nightshirts sewn on your old black singer, no birthday card addressed in a shaky but businesslike hand. You asked me if I would be sad when it happened, and I am sad. But the iris I moved from your house now hold in the dusty, dry fists of their roots, green knives and forks, as if waiting for dinner, as if spring were a feast. I thank you for that. Were it not for the way you taught me to look at the world, to see the life at play in everything, I would have to be lonely forever. I had wonderful parents. I really could do no wrong, you know, even though I tried, you know, like most kids. But they were very nurturing. It makes all the difference in the world as for you know, somebody in the arts, I think, to have that kind of support. My father was not. He was a little more reserved about my interests, but mother, you know, from the time I was a little boy, I would bring her drawings and get praised and so on. And I still have this impulse. She's been gone 7 years. I write a poem now, and if she were there, I would take it and put it on her lap and say, "Here's what I did today," you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, that's so nice. Yeah, beautiful. You have a poem about telling one of your mother's friends about her death, which.
Yeah, that poem is called Pearl.
Yeah.
What happened was that on the morning, Mother died during the night in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and it's about roughly 100 miles up to the area where she was raised. And she had an old friend who was in a nursing home there, and then this one last first cousin. And I first went to see the friend in the nursing home. She said a really lovely thing. We were sitting there, and she said she knew that this was coming, that Mother had written her and so on, she said, "Ted, your mother and I were such good friends that we could sit together in a room for an hour and neither of us would think we had to say a word." I thought that was lovely. So then I drove on over to Elkader, Iowa, where this last first cousin lived, Pearl. Elkader, Iowa, a morning in March, the Turkey River running brown and wrinkly from a late spring snow in Minnesota. A white 2-story house on Mulberry Street, windows flashing with sun. And I had come 100 miles to tell our cousin Pearl that her childhood playmate, Vera, my mother, had died. I knocked and knocked at the door with this lace-covered oval of glass, and at last she came from the shadows and with one finger hooked the curtain aside, peered into my face through her spectacles, and held that pose, a grainy family photograph that could have been that of her mother. I called out, "Pearl, it's Ted, it's Vera's boy," and my voice broke, for it came to me, nearly 60, I was still my mother's boy, that boy for the rest of my life. Pearl, at 90, was 1 year older than Mother, and a widow for 20 years. She wore a pale blue cardigan buttoned over a house dress, and she shook my hand in the tentative way of old women who rarely have hands to shake. When I told her that Mother was gone, that she died the evening before, she said she was sorry, that Vera wrote me a letter a while ago to say she wasn't good. We went to the kitchen, and I sat at the table while she heated a pan of water and made us cups of instant coffee. She told me of a time when the two of them were girls and crawled out onto the porch roof to spy on my Aunt Mabel and a suitor who were swinging below. We got so excited we had to pee, and we couldn't wait, and peed right there on the roof, and it trickled down over the edge and dripped in the bushes, but Mabel and that fella never heard. We took our cups into her living room, where stripes from the drawn blinds draped over the World's Fair satin pillows. She took the couch, and I took a chair across from her. "I've had some trouble with health myself," she said, taking off her glasses and wiping them. And I said she looked good, though. And she said, "I've started seeing people who aren't here. I know they're not real, but I see them the same. They come in the house and sit around and never say a word. They keep their heads down or cover their faces with cloths. I'm not afraid, but I don't know what they want of me. You won't be able to see, but one's right there on the staircase where the light falls through that window, a man in a light gray outfit." I turned to look at the landing where a patch of light fell over the carpeted steps. Sometimes I think that my Max is with them. One seems to know his way around the house. "What bothers me, Ted, is that they've started to write out lists of everything I own. They go from room to room, three or four at a time, picking up things and putting them back. I've talked to Wilson, the chiropractor, and he just says that maybe it's time for me to go to the nursing home. I asked her what a regular doctor said, and she said she didn't go there anymore, that he's not much good. 'But surely there's medicine,' I said, and she said maybe so. And then there was a pause that filled the room. After a while, we began to talk again of other things, and there were some stories we laughed a little over, and I wept a little. And then it was time for me to go to drive the long miles back, and she slowly walked me to the door and took my hand again, our warm, bony hands among the light hands of the shadows that reached to touch us but drew back. And I cleared my throat and said I hoped she'd take care of herself and think about seeing a real medical doctor. And she said she'd give some thought to that, and I took my hand from hers and waved goodbye, and the door closed. And behind the lace, the others stepped out of the stripes of light and resumed their inventory, touching the spoon I used and subtracting it from the sum of the spoons in the kitchen drawer." I've done read that at a lot of occasions and asked people in the audience if they have known people like that who've begun to see these phantoms late in life, and many, many people have. It's very quite common, actually. I talked to a therapist about this incident after it happened, and he said that what was unusual about this situation was that she still understood they weren't real.
Yeah.
Yeah. And ordinarily you drift over into when they become very real, you know. My favorite detail in that poem is the instant coffee.
Well, I love the way you move between worlds in the writing, too. I mean, it's such a beautiful poem. Mm. I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Went quickly. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here.
Sure, I'm glad to have been here.
It's the poetry of Ted Kooser, Poet Laureate of the United States. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is Joseph Wilk. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.